Now, in our world, a death is a tragedy, really, isn't it? At funerals, we may celebrate someone's life. We don't tend to celebrate death. It's not something we kind of get excited about and celebrate. People, of course, may wish to die if they're in pain, and people now, don't they, get the opportunity in some countries to choose death. But I don't think anyone would celebrate that, would they? In 2013, when Margaret Thatcher died, hundreds of people gathered in London to have a party to celebrate her passing. But there's something kind of sick about that, isn't there? It's not, you know, it doesn't fill me with kind of, you know, confidence in humanity. There's something quite odd about that, isn't there? We don't tend to celebrate death. Even the singer Billy Bragg said that celebrating Thatcher's death achieves nothing. Because death doesn't achieve anything, does it? But the Bible claims that in the case of Jesus, death achieves something. At Easter, Christians are rightfully celebrating a death, not because death in itself is a good thing, but because of what the death of Christ achieved. There's no one else, I don't think, in the whole of history who you can point to and can say that their death achieved anything for anybody else. And yet that's our chief claim, isn't it? That the death of Christ achieved something. It's not just that his life achieved it and his death was kind of slightly sad. No, in his death, in his life and in his death, it achieved something for other people. Well, we've reached chapters 18 and 19 in John, which are often called the Passion Narrative. And passion in this context means suffering. It comes from a Latin word, not a normal kind of use of the word passion. But it means the suffering of Christ. Verse 1 of chapter 18 tells us that when he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. This is the Garden of Gethsemane. This is the garden where Jesus will be betrayed and then arrested. From there, he'll be taken to the high priest and then to Pilate. He'll be sentenced to death. He'll be crucified and buried in a tomb. This is the hour, as we've been thinking, that Jesus has been sent for. The hour of his glory, as we thought last weekend. And the promise of life that John has been teaching us about, remember chapter 20, verse 31? These are written that you may have life in his name. This life that Jesus has been sent to bring, we learn, is only possible through his death. Our life is possible only through his death. And the titles for all of our talks for the next 2 or 3 weeks are going to be Life Through Death. But there's something specific about each one. And this week, specifically, I think we see Jesus' death in two words, satisfaction and substitution. So we're going to think about those two words in terms of Jesus' death. His death satisfied God's wrath. And his death was a substitution for our death. So let's have a look at verses 1 to 11 particularly. Jesus' death satisfied God's wrath. Let me clarify first the heading, and then we'll come to see some things about that. Have a look at verse 11. It's right at the end of our section. And this is why I've titled it this way. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me, says Jesus. This is the climax of the first 10 verses. Jesus is saying, shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? And we have to understand this image of a cup is all over in the Old Testament. I can read a few verses out in a minute, which will demonstrate that. But the cup in the Old Testament is a sign of what comes to somebody from the Lord. Okay, now it could be there are cups of blessing. Say Psalm 16:5, the Lord is my chosen portion and my cup. You hold my lot. You see, the Lord is his cup. He's got everything he wants is held in this cup, and it's the Lord. But most of the time, it's not a picture of blessing. It's a picture of the Lord's wrath. You see, whether the cup is a blessing from the Lord or wrath from the Lord depends on where you stand in relation to the Lord. Okay, so what we get from the Lord is either blessing or it's wrath. And the biggest story in the Old Testament is a cup of wrath. So let me take you through two or three verses. Psalm 75, verse 8. For in the hand of the Lord there is a cup with foaming wine, well mixed, and he pours out from it, and all the wicked of the earth shall drain it down to its dregs. Isaiah 51, now spoken to God's people. Wake yourself. Wake yourself. Stand up, O Jerusalem. You who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath, who have drunk to the dregs the bowl, the cup of staggering. And then a bit later on in Isaiah 51, verse 22, thus says your Lord, the Lord, your God, who pleads the cause of his people, behold, I have taken from your hand the cup of staggering, the bowl of my wrath you shall drink no more. It's pretty clear, isn't it? In the context of the Old Testament, the cup is a cup of wrath. Jesus knows that as he dies, as he goes to his death, he is drinking the cup of God's wrath. Jesus, we might say, saw his death as taking on himself the wrath of God and satisfying it, drinking it down to its dregs. Now, God's wrath isn't a very popular topic of conversation. Try striking that up with somebody in the street and, well, you wouldn't have much of a conversation, probably. After all, the best well-known fact about God surely is that he's a God of love, right? So how can God be a God of love and yet be a God of wrath? Isn't anger sinful? And all those kind of questions. And yet we know ourselves, don't we, that even when we, even though it's not a kind of a perfect sense, when somebody wrongs us, you know, we get upset about it, don't we? We get angry about it. And we can feel kind of justified. You know, there's something right about not liking being offended and being kind of when somebody treats you in a way which is not right. There's a kind of rightness about my reaction of kind of anger at that. And yet our reactions are so tainted, aren't they, by sin, and are so complex. But when a perfectly holy God, in whom there is no sin and is nothing wrong, is faced with sin and rebellion against him, why should it be wrong for God to be offended and angry at that? See, God's anger and his wrath are not born out of a lack of self-control, as it often is in our experience, but they're the result of his perfect holiness and an intolerance of anything unholy. So God is angry. God is the God of wrath. That's key, isn't it, for us to understand what Jesus meant. And Jesus saw his death as a drinking of that cup of satisfying, drinking down to the dregs the wrath of God. And you may well raise the question, why is God angry? What is it that has aroused the anger of God? If you remember John 16, when Jesus was explaining to his disciples the job of the Holy Spirit, he summed it up in these words. The Holy Spirit will prove the world to be in the wrong about sin and righteousness and judgment, about sin because people do not believe in me. You see, God's anger is aroused by sin. He's angry with sin. He's angry with people's rejection of him. He's angry with people's rejection of Jesus. Even in John, as we've seen, the term world means the humankind in rebellion against God. That's where the world stands. That's where we as part of the world naturally stand in rebellion against God. And God is angry. God is a God of wrath against that. The world in general have rejected God's plans. And they've rejected his son. See, God's anger is a just and a righteous anger. But Jesus' death was a satisfaction of that anger, a satisfaction of that wrath. He drank the cup down to its dregs. That's why we're calling this section a satisfaction. But there are a number of things we can note from our verses about this death of Jesus, this satisfactory death. The death of Jesus satisfied God's wrath against sin. And the first thing is that it was a voluntary death. That's pretty striking, isn't it? As I was reading through, I was struck by this very much, that Jesus is completely in control, isn't he, of everything that happens. I don't know if that struck you as you went through. Let's walk through it. Verse 1, when he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place, because Jesus had often met there with the disciples. So Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. And reading this far, it sounds like Jesus, unfortunately, is about to walk into this trap that's been laid for him, like an unsuspecting animal, just into a trap that's been laid. But then we have these amazing words in verse 4. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" He knew all that was going to happen to him. This is quite amazing, isn't it? Now, Jesus knew everything that was going to happen, but if Jesus knew all that was going to happen, why did he go to the garden? The garden that he'd so often gone to. And exactly the kind of time that Judas thought he might be there. And of course, the answer is that he went there precisely because Judas knew that that's where he would be at that time. In fact, you might say that the reason Jesus went there so often in the past was to make this event absolutely sure. Of course he would be there. Jesus knew everything, didn't he? He knew where he would be betrayed. He knew where Judas would be. He knew as he walked across the Kidron Valley into the garden that he would be met by Judas and a detachment of soldiers. It was a voluntary death. Nobody took his life from him. He lays it down of his own accord. He lays it from him and he takes it up again. It's a voluntary death, but it's a determined death too. See, the other thing that John is clear about is his continuing kind of authority. He's not just a willing volunteer. He's not just a willing actor, if you like, in this play. We actually see that he's the director of the play. He's calling all the shots. He's making the moves. Do you see how John pits the authority of the human authority against Jesus' divine authority? The band that Judas led were carrying torches and lanterns and weapons. These are kind of instruments of human power, aren't they? This signifies humans, you know, everything they've got. This is what we've got. And they're coming to Jesus with maximum force to arrest him. Maybe it's the equivalent of sending the army in our day. You know, it's the power that we have. They come face to face, though, with Jesus, unarmed, defenseless from a human point of view, and they completely disintegrate, don't they? Jesus, in verse 4, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," said Jesus. And Judas the traitor was standing there with him. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Again he asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they said. Jesus answered, "I told you, I'm he. If you're looking for me, then let these men go." Isn't it amazing? These people have come out with all their power, everything they've got, to arrest an unarmed and defenseless man, and they crumble, don't they? In fact, I don't know about you, but as John tells the story, they seem like gibbering fools. All they can do is repeat exactly the same question that they've been asked, the question they've been asked. You know, they haven't got anything else to say. They're gibbering fools in the presence of Jesus. This is the authority of not simply a mere man, is it? This is divine authority. Jesus has divine authority. He's calling the shots. Now, there's some ambiguity in Jesus' reply. "I am he." A word-for-word translation would be I am. And on the one hand, this is just the way in Greek you'd say, "It's me." And yet, for John's readers, perhaps, there's something else where he's pointing to, isn't there? Here is the one who is at the same time a fully human Nazarene, and yet the great I am. This is one. This is God clothed in humankind, in human flesh. The name I Am is the one that God revealed himself to, isn't it, to Moses and his people in the Old Testament. Divine authority, you see, belongs to Jesus. And the reaction of these this band just supports that view, doesn't it? They drew back and fell to the ground. I don't know exactly why they did that. I'm not quite sure whether they saw something or whether there was something in Jesus' voice, but certainly they reacted in this way, which supports the fact that Jesus exercised a divine authority over them. Perhaps, as one commentator suggests, John writes this because they reacted better than they knew. We often read, don't we, people's comments in the Bible. We think, well, I'm not sure they kind of knew what they were saying, but they spoke better than they knew. We'll come across that in a minute. Well, perhaps here we have an event where people react better than they knew. What was it that they saw? They probably didn't know. What was it they heard? They didn't know. All they knew was this guy was somebody they had to bow down onto the ground or fall onto the ground over. See, there's a reality in this picture that we see that is hidden from those in the picture, but revealed to those looking at it. And then John shows us that these events fulfill Jesus' earlier promise. I have not lost one of those you gave me, in verse 9. I have not lost one of those you gave me. And we see that Jesus has been directing events all along. He knows the whole story. And then look at Peter's response. Another human display of power in response to the threat. Verse 10, then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus, and the significance of that comes a little bit later on. But again, Jesus, in full control, verse 11, commands Peter, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? So this cup, his death, is a cup that's from the Father. It's all according to plan. It's a determined death. He has no thoughts of escaping the hour. Jesus isn't looking for a way out. In fact, he came in, didn't he, to the garden. He looked for a way in. These events led to Jesus' satisfying death, and their voluntary and determined effort to bring about the plan of God. Now, when I was studying at university, I didn't learn a lot about business, because I didn't really know what it was. But anyway, one thing I can remember doing quite a lot of was something called a SWOT analysis. You've probably done these if you've been in management. You have to identify the strengths and the weaknesses and the opportunities and the threats. And a good manager, you see, is one who can turn a threat into an opportunity, right? So if you see a threat coming, you anticipate it and you can turn it into opportunity. They're a great kind of manager. They're in control of their circumstances and what happens to them. But when we talk about Jesus being in control, it's not just that he can kind of foresee the threats and turns them into opportunities. That isn't the kind of picture we're given. No, we're given the sense that Jesus is the one who is directing the events in the first place. Maybe we could think of actors in a play. You know, the actors in a play or a film, they rarely see the whole thing, do they? If you've ever been in a school performance, you come on, you do your bit, you get off again, and you hope that it makes sense to everyone else who's watching. And when you're shooting a film, you don't even shoot in the right order, you just shoot the bits, you know, and hopefully somebody cuts and pastes everything together so it looks good to those who are watching. And Jesus is not just an actor, he's playing his part and leaving, and hopes the whole thing makes sense. He's the director, isn't he? He's like an actor-director, if you get those. He sees the whole thing, he knows the beginning from the end, he puts it all together. This is the picture of Jesus that we have. He's got divine authority. He's not only a willing actor, but he's the director. But there remains a question, if you followed so far. The question is this. Why is it that Jesus should drink this cup? We've seen that Jesus drinks the cup of God's wrath. But we also know that Jesus was innocent of all sin. So how is it that Jesus is drinking the cup of God's wrath when God wasn't wrathful at all towards Jesus? Well, why is it? I mean, surely God isn't angry with Jesus, so how can his death take away anger that is not directed at him? How does it help us that Jesus died? when it is us and not Jesus to whom God's anger is directed. And that's why we need the second point. And it's answered, the second point is about substitution. See, Jesus' death wasn't just, well, I was going to use the word propitiatory, and I changed it, to satisfying God's wrath. Why Jesus' death was one that was satisfactory, in that it satisfied God's wrath. And why does that help us? Because Jesus' death was also substitutionary. Substitution, in other words, makes sense of satisfaction. Otherwise, Jesus' death had no way of bringing any benefit to anyone else. Jesus didn't drink the cup of God's wrath that was directed towards him against his own sin, but he did it for the sin of others. Verses 12 to 14. Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. We've thought about this already while the children were still with us, haven't we? But these words that are being quoted by John here are words that we came across in chapter 11, verse 50. But you might recall that as we were there, Caiaphas wasn't saying these words because he was kind of in sympathy with God's plan. No, what happened was Jesus was causing trouble in their eyes, stirring up the people. They didn't know what to do about it. And he was saying it would be much, you know, this guy Jesus is going to have to die to save others. In order to protect Judaism and the temple and our nation, this guy is going to have to die. But he spoke better than he knew, didn't he? Because this guy would die. He would die for the people. But not in the way that he thought. Jesus would die for others, in behalf of others, and in the place of others. And what follows, verses 15 to 27, shows us particularly two kinds of people in whose place Jesus stood. Firstly, he stood in the place of failures. We see this, don't we, in the story of Peter. He denies Jesus, knowing Jesus three times. John tells a story. He oscillates between Peter's denials of Jesus and Jesus' commitment to the Father's plan. It's obviously a deliberate technique here to bring out, on the one hand, Peter's unfaithfulness, but Jesus' faithfulness. Peter's a failure. Jesus is faithful. The failure of one is deserving of God's wrath. The faithfulness of the other diverts God's wrath. Peter was questioned about his teacher and was intimidated by a servant girl in verse 17 and then other servants in verses 25 and 26. Jesus was questioned about his teaching and about his disciples, and he stood up to the highest authority in the establishment, the high priest. Peter escaped physical harm by telling lies and was making himself comfortable by the fire in verse 18. Jesus was slapped in the face for telling the truth and had his hands bound like a criminal. Peter in verse 18 is standing with them. He's not with Jesus, he's with them. Just like Judas actually remember he was standing there with them. Not with Jesus, opposite Jesus. Peter, in this sense, is standing with them. He's trying to look inconspicuous. He's trying to assimilate into the crowd. Jesus, on the other hand, is alone, and he's exposed. Peter's unfaithfulness, but Jesus' faithfulness. And yet the cock crowing in verse 27 is a reminder, isn't it, of Jesus' foreknowledge of Peter's failure. That's what Jesus had foretold in chapter 13, 38. He'd promised, Peter had promised, remember this, that he would lay down his life for Jesus. And yet Jesus knew that Peter would disown him as he laid down his life for Peter. And yet Jesus chose Peter to be his disciple. Isn't that amazing? He didn't choose Peter because of his kind of spiritual prowess, because of his quick mind, or his kind of natural boldness, although we do see his boldness coming out for good in other ways, don't we, in Acts. But Jesus, it has to be said, chose Peter in spite of himself, despite his failures. John is pretty clear that it would have been obvious to those around that Peter was one of his disciples. We see, don't we, that Peter had to wait for John. John went in, and then John said to the servant girl, "Can you let my mate Peter in?" And she asked the question, "You aren't one of these man's disciples too, are you?" But of course he's with John, so of course he is. And then we're told in verse 26 of the high priest's servant, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off. So here's Malchus's relative. No doubt he's told him that this guy had cut his ear off. Otherwise, John probably wouldn't have given us the information. It's obvious, isn't it, that Peter was with Jesus. He was one of his disciples. And yet his failure to admit that and his denial of Jesus is such a failure, isn't it? A human failure. And yet I'm grateful for Peter's story. Not because it makes me feel better about my own failure, but because it shows, doesn't it, that human failure is not beyond the reaches of Christ's offer of salvation. Isn't that amazing? I mean, who of us would dare to say that we would have fared any better? See, Christ's offer of salvation reaches beyond human failure. Human failure and my own failure is key to my valuing the gospel, actually, isn't it? It's only as I see my own failure that I see the faithfulness of Jesus in all its wonderful richness, and that I can take hold of that. And in one sense, growing as a Christian is growing in our understanding of the failure that is endemic to us, and yet the faithfulness that Jesus displayed. Some of you will have read books by Jerry Bridges, who you may know has died now. I watched an interview with him online somewhere, and he came up with this quote. He said, "The depth to which someone appreciates the gospel is consistent with how much he sees more and more sin in his life. If we do not acknowledge ourselves as sinners, then we tend not to put much value in the gospel." And he was saying that as you grow as a Christian, you realize the depth of your sin. And you realize that, but that helps you to love and value the gospel more and more. Of course, we mourn our sin, don't we? We don't celebrate our sin. We don't rejoice in our sinfulness. We mourn it. And we endeavor to become more like Jesus, and he's working in us by his Spirit to make us more like him. But ultimately, my salvation rests not on my own faithfulness, not on my maturing as a Christian, not on anything apart from the death of Christ, who stands in the place of failures. But also, Christ stands in the place of rebels. The other thing that Jesus' kind of informal trial by Annas reinforces is their kind of determined rejection of Jesus, don't they? Their rebellion, if you like. The reference in verse 19 there to the high priest is probably a reference to Annas. Now, this needs a little bit of explanation because there are two people who are both called high priest here, right? So Annas was the father-in-law of Caiaphas. We learn that in verse 13. And he used to be the high priest. So Annas used to be the high priest, but the predecessor of Pilate basically removed him from office for no particular reason. This was not something that Jews recognized. And so they continue to call Annas and reference him as the high priest, even though Caiaphas was the high priest that year. So that's why we have two high priests. And that's why they're both referred to as high priest. But here we see people's determination to reject Jesus. They had no kind of desire for truth. See, Jesus' point in verse 20 is that he hasn't done anything or said anything in secret. He's always acted openly and spoken openly. He suggests they speak to other people. Who would have been able to act as witnesses. They would have easily been able to gather witnesses about what Jesus said and did if they were really concerned with giving Jesus a fair and proper trial, if they were really concerned with the truth. And his point is that there are loads of them available. There are loads of witnesses out there. Why don't you go and ask, get some of them? But they weren't interested in witnesses because they weren't interested in truth. In verse 23, if I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? What an irony. An official slaps Jesus in the face for answering the high priest in this way. And yet, as we know in Hebrews, Jesus is the high priest, isn't he? He is the kind of reality to which this guy in his office was pointing. And yet he is slapped in the face for the way he speaks to the shadow of which he is the reality. They didn't want the truth. They were rebels at heart. Well, what has all this got to do with us? Well, we've sang some brilliant songs, haven't we, this morning, as usual. I really love that one. Let me read it out to you again, that we've just sung, Why All My Fear and Unbelief. And I want to just open that and look at it as I read it. I'm going to read it as a poem, I guess, because I can't remember the tune anyway, but I think it works really well, doesn't it? Listen to this. Why all my fear and unbelief? Has not the Father put to grief his spotless Son for me? And will the righteous judge of men condemn me for that debt of sin discharged at Calvary? Answer, no. Complete atonement you have made, and to the utmost limit paid, all that your people owed. How can God's wrath my soul distress if sheltered in your righteousness and covered by your blood? Since Christ has my release procured and freely in my place endured the whole of wrath divine. Payment God will not twice demand, first at my dying Saviour's hand and then again at mine. Turn then, my soul, to joy and rest. The merits of my great high priest have brought my liberty. Trust in his all-sufficient blood, nor fear my banishment from God, for Jesus died for me. We can have great confidence, can't we, that Jesus has drunk to the dregs the cup of God's wrath for my sin. All of it. Past and future. He's drunk it down to the dregs. There's nothing left to drink. There's no more debt to pay. It's been paid. Isn't that wonderfully liberating truth? There is not a sin in the past that is not covered by the death of Jesus. There is not a sin in the future that cannot be either. Christ died for us. Or think of the next song we're going to sing shortly. When Satan tempts me to despair and tells me of the guilt within, upward I look and see him there who made an end to all my sin. Because the sinless Saviour died, my sinful soul is counted free. For God the just is satisfied to look on him and pardon me. To look on him and pardon me. Jesus' death brought satisfaction. God is satisfied by the death of Christ in my place. And that should give us great confidence. Doesn't mean we celebrate sin. We mourn sin. We seek by his Spirit to change into the likeness of his Son. And yet we need not despair. We can have great confidence that Jesus, that God, will not demand that payment twice. But there's a flip side to all of this, isn't there? Because all of this depends on how you stand in relation to the Lord, as we thought at the beginning. The cup that is from the Lord, the nature of that cup, depends on where you stand before him. Will it be a cup of blessing? Or will it be a cup of wrath? You see, there is a cup that remains. There is a cup that remains, and it's the destiny of all who do not follow Christ. Listen to these words from Revelation 14, verse 10. He will also drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger, and he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Revelation 16:19 tells us that the great city, this represents the human kind of system against God, including everyone, every person in it. The great city was split into three parts. The nations of the cities fell, and God remembered Babylon the Great to make her drain the cup of the wine of the fury of his wrath. See, Jesus' death brings us life because his death was a death that satisfied the wrath of God against us. And it was a death that was a substitution for our death. But it needs to be grasped with faith, doesn't it? We need to grasp that with faith.